history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there, eye-opening stories, inspiring stories, amazing stories just waiting to be told. All we need to do is ask a few questions and take the time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service to our country. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Something unique happened in this past week that maybe you heard about on the news, but I wanted to make sure to emphasize it on the program this week because the man who inspired it made a big impression on me, and I'm sure on many of you listening right now. A 400-mile funeral procession took the body of USS Arizona survivor Don Stratton from Colorado Springs, where he spent his final years, through Kansas and all the way to Red Cloud, Nebraska, where he was born. His flag-draped casket arrived on March 2nd, which was dubbed Don Stratton Day in his hometown. A bridge on Interstate 25 in Colorado Springs is named after him as well. And we only have an hour on the radio, so we can't catalog all the honors that he received, but Mr. Stratton's passing on February 15th leaves just two surviving members now of the Arizona's crew from December 7th, 1941. Perhaps you've read Don's best-selling book, All the Gallant Men, which his family hopes will turn into a feature film someday. Or maybe you've seen one of the countless interviews he gave in an effort to honor the nearly 1,200 shipmates he lost at Pearl Harbor. We were fortunate to have one of those interviews on Hometown Heroes, and we're going to hear some of that today. But we're also going to hear some of the tributes to Don from his memorial service in Colorado Springs. You'll hear references to the basic elements of his remarkable story in his own humble telling, and also from those who admired him so. The majority of his body was burned when the Arizona was hit. He had no fingerprints for the final 78 years of his life as a result, and he wouldn't have made it off the ship alive except for a seaman on a neighboring ship who disobeyed a direct order and tossed a lifeline that saved Don's life and five others. Learning the identity of that life-saving sailor and then making sure he was appropriately honored was a passionate quest of Don's, one which was fulfilled not long after we sat down with him in 2017. We're going to begin today with part of that conversation, starting with his memories of growing up during the Great Depression as one of four children in his family in Red Cloud, a town of a little more than 1,000 in south-central Nebraska.
It was tough days. That was a depression, and we lived hand-to-mouth, about. That was it.
Couldn't take anything for granted?
Not really, and you didn't have anything, jobs or anything. You didn't have any money. You couldn't buy anything. You couldn't do anything. You just existed.
So what does a kid growing up in those conditions dream about? What does a kid like that think he's going to do someday with his life?
Well, I don't think you think a hell of a lot about it. You just live from day to day, and you hope that you could be there the next day.
And not long after you finished high school, you decided to join Uncle Sam's Navy. What was that all about? I mean, I don't think you saw a whole lot of water in Red Cloud, Nebraska.
Well, that's just one of those things that you $21 a month, and it sounds like a lot of money, and no money around at that time. And right now, $21 an hour is not too bad, so you know what the difference is. I was just wanting to get somewhere where I could maybe do something with myself, and that was it. And the Navy looked like it.
Was it what you expected, or did you have a rude awakening?
Well, it was different. I mean, the boot camp was different, and all the things, and aboard ship was different. But you learn to live with it.
And your ship is a ship whose name everyone recognizes. Probably many of the people listening have been to pay respect to your ship and the 1,177 men who died aboard that ship on December 7th, 1941. But what can you tell me about the battleship USS Arizona before December 7th? You probably picked it up in Puget Sound?
Yeah, I did, and we went into dry dock there, and then we went to Hawaii. And then I was in a deck division, the 6th Division on the port side, and I and another seaman, Harl Nelson, we worked on the incinerator. I had to burn everything, and even at sea, in simulated war times or something, we even had to burn the garbage.
Burning the trash in the ship's incinerator.
And like 1,700 men, so that, you know, in the galley to feed them and that, whatever, a lot of people.
And you said your hometown had 1,500 people.
Right.
So this battleship's bigger than your hometown.
That's right.
What was that like? How'd you get along with those other guys?
Just like you got along with everybody else. You went through boot camp, and we just made do with what was available. And you had shipmates, and you had people that you didn't pay much attention to. And most generally, the deck division, the engineering division was segregated, and you didn't have much to do with them or anything else. And you paid attention to orders. That was about it.
Mm-hmm. And I want to get a sense of your duties aboard the ship, but one aside, one of the stories I've become familiar with over the years by talking to friends of members of the band who were killed that day was the story of your ship's band. Every single member of that band was killed on December 7th, but they had been in a battle of the bands. Do you remember ever hearing or watching that band perform?
Oh, yes. They were on the fantail. They were actually there to perform Colors every morning for Colors, and they sound the battle stations, and they all were in the number two handling room, and most of them up around the big 14-inch guns, and they were all killed that day.
So many were, and you came close to it. Before that, though, what was your understanding of what your duties on this ship were going to be?
Well, we just wholly stoned the deck, and we clean sweep downs, and we've done a lot of chipping and painting, and salt water has a lot to do with that, so that was just an everyday occurrence.
And this story and December 7th has been a part of your life for so long now. There's so much that you know now that you didn't know then. You know why there are a lot of reasons people should have seen it coming, why there were things that happened that morning that could have tipped off the ships at Pearl Harbor. But did you have any idea before that Sunday morning that anything like this could even happen?
We never had nothing. That only thing we had that was an inkling of any kind was when we were at sea on maneuvers, where they were only allowed a 3-gallon bucket of water every day because they had evaporators, and it was just a trial thing, I know, and I knew there was something in the wind, so that's exactly what they was doing.
And I know that you have told this story so many times, and every time you do, you're honoring the memory of those 1,177 from the Arizona and the 2,400 Americans who died at Pearl that day. But how did you experience that morning? What's the first thing you remember about December 7th, 1941?
Well, it was nothing. It was just quarter for muster, and then we had chow, and then we had colors and whatever. So it was just a normal day for us.
So what was the first indication that it wasn't a normal day?
Well, it was just we had a little notice there, and they had the sound general quarters, and everybody was on duty, so here and there, and aboard ship, my battle station was a side setter in the port anti-aircraft guns on the port side, and that was up about 55, 60 feet in the air on the tripod mast on the foremast.
And people hear you say that, and maybe some of them have already read your book, All the Gallant Men, or they've seen one of your interviews or heard you before. But when people imagine that morning and they think about you being in that position, that many feet in the air with these Japanese planes coming in and bombs dropping, I'm sure they say, how in the world did you survive? You ever wonder that yourself?
Well, it had to be a lot to do with the good Lord, I guess. But we were kind of trapped up there. We got out of the director and on the deck there, and the vessel was alongside a repair ship, and we got a hold of a seaman there that threw us a heaving line that's a line with a lead on the end to stretch it out, and they small line, and then he added a big, heavier line, and we pulled that across, and we tied it off on the Arizona, and we started hand over hand across it, and we were already burnt. I was burned like over 60% of my body, I guess, at that time.
And how did that occur? You were in that position on the foremast when the big explosion happened?
The bomb that hit on the starboard side behind number two turret went into 1,000,000 pounds of ammunition, and it blew up. And that just was a fireball that just engulfed us up there where we were at, and no way to escape or get off. So until we got the line there to go hand over hand across, we were kind of just stymied up there, and we finally got off. Six of us went across there.
I know you're not into getting all syrupy and sappy. But I'm just trying to imagine what those moments were like when you're engulfed in flames and your flesh is burning and you're trapped and you can't go anywhere. What do you do?
You try to figure out what to do. That's it.
Are you looking around? Are you watching what's happening? Are you closing your eyes and praying? I mean,
no, you're just trying to get out of the way from the flames and thinking about how the hell am I going to get out of here?
So if that seaman hadn't had that idea to tie that line.
Well, we kind of indicated that we wanted to get off of there, and he throwed us a heaving line, which is a small line, and then tied on a heavier line, and it was about probably 65, 70 feet across there, and we had to go hand over hand across there.
So already you said 60%+ of your body had been burned. So is that upper body, lower body?
Well, the whole body, everything.
But your hands were okay?
My hands were burned. I don't even have any fingerprints.
Well, was that from the explosion or was that from going down that line?
That was both.
So your hands are burnt, and then you have to hold on to a line or else you're going to fall to your death.
Right.
With hands that are already burnt, and I can't imagine what that feels like, the pain that you must have been experiencing. Or did the adrenaline take over?
Well, it's just self-preservation.
So you get down to that other ship, the Vestal, which is next to the Arizona. I've interviewed a couple guys who are on that ship, and they've described what your ship looked like. But once you got aboard on the Vestal, there's still a lot going on, probably. What did you see from there?
Well, we stood around there for quite a while. The Vestal was busy with firing their guns and whatever and trying to get away from the side of the Arizona and the explosion. And they finally got us in the shore boat and took us to the beach, and they picked us up in an open-air truck and took us to the hospital.
And how long were you in the hospital?
A year.
That's a long time.
That's a long time. Wasn't quite that long. It was like till the next September.
And I'm sure, well, I've read some of your story. I don't want to put words in your mouth. I want to understand how you experienced it. So very few people alive experienced what you experienced. You're in all this pain, and you know you're going to recover. But was it a daily basis in those days that followed that you were learning of other guys that you knew from the ship who didn't make it?
Well, we most generally figured that, but there was a few ex-sailors in the hospital with us and everything, so but we knew we'd suffered a devastating hit and a lot of casualties, but it took a lot of baths, saltwater baths, and a lot of healing and a lot of patience. And
Where did that come from? You're a pretty young guy. You haven't been through a whole lot until this.
Well, you do what you have to do.
Did your parents know you were alive, or did that take a while?
No, they didn't. They got a notice that I didn't make it, and then they got a notice that I did. But they sent us back to Mare Island Hospital and went through a lot of skin grafts and a lot of stuff, a lot of baths, a lot of skin grafts, a lot of time laying. They put us on a bunk and put a canopy over the top of us and covered the canopy with a blanket and put light bulbs in the canopy to keep us warm and kept the burns open to the healing air.
Don Stratton went through an unthinkable ordeal on December 7th, 1941, not to mention the 10 months that followed before he finally emerged from the hospital. Think about the pain, the uncertainty, the devastation of losing so many. But part of what makes Don's story so powerful and inspirational is what he decided to do after his medical discharge from the Navy. We'll hear about that when we come back and hear some of the words shared about the late USS Arizona survivor whose body was carried home to Red Cloud, Nebraska this week. This special edition of Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myEECU.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Donald Stratton was a gallant man, a life well lived, a man well loved, and a service never forgotten.
That's Colorado Senator Cory Gardner at the memorial service for USS Arizona survivor Don Stratton. Don's body was returned to his native Red Cloud, Nebraska this week. You'll hear more from that service, including some powerful words from Senator Gardner in a moment. And if you're a reader, I highly recommend you pick up the best-selling book, All the Gallant Men. It's Don Stratton's amazing story from Pearl Harbor and beyond, written with the help of Ken Geyer. With Stratton's passing at the age of 97, there are now only two men alive today, California's Lou Conter and Utah's Ken Potts, who were on the USS Arizona on December 7, 1941. Before we hear more from the memorial service for this American hero, let's hear more in his own words. After being burned over the majority of his body on December 7th and spending the better part of a year in the hospital, Don received a medical discharge. His service to our country was complete. But what did he decide to do? Re-enlist, of course.
Well, that was just another thing that happened. I wanted to go back into the Navy, so I went back after I was home for about a year, and my whole left side healed up really much from the medical discharge. So I re-enlisted and went back in, and they put me on I went to boot camp again because it hadn't caught up on my shots and stuff, and I went to island there in the bay, and they put me aboard a destroyer, DD-406 USS Stack, STACK, and we headed for the South Pacific right away. And we were in on the invasion of the land in New Guinea and a couple of islands offshore there. And we went to Guadalcanal and picked up troops to put in the Philippines and the Lady, and we were in the Battle of Leyte Gulf, and we were in the Battle of Luzon Gulf, and we led all the invasions in with the minesweeps and the destroyers protecting them, and finally Okinawa, and we were on pickup patrol 300 miles north of Okinawa between there and Japan, and for the kamikazes coming down, and let them know down below that they were on their way, and that was kind of hazardous. We lost five ships one night there, and one time there was over 100 ships and sunk and damaged in Karamret or Wise Man Cove and at that time, and then they sent me back to the States, and the war was over, and I had a game.
And I understand that you lived that and that you've told your story many times, so that is, in a way, old hat to you. But you do understand how crazy that sounds to most people, right? That you were burned over the majority of your body. You still don't have any feeling in your fingers that you haven't had for 75 years. You're recovering for a year in the hospital. You've been medically discharged. But you sign up to go back, and you end up fighting the rest of the war. Why? Why was that so important to you?
Well, it's just one of those things that happens, I guess.
Was it?
Felt like maybe I should be there, but whatever happened, but that's the way it worked.
And the title of your book is All the Gallant Men, and you're honoring those who died December 7th, and really the 406,000 Americans who died in the war. But it strikes me that just that action you took, I mean, you are the gallant man. Did you feel that you were doing something beyond what was asked of you?
No, the heroes were still out there.
Still on your ship.
Yeah.
What'd your parents think when you re-enlisted?
Well, actually, they didn't want me to go, but they said if that's what you're made up your mind to do, it's your life to live.
Did you feel that you were avenging the deaths of your shipmates?
Not really. Just the thing that surprise attacked and didn't get a chance to fight back too much, so was still in the same predicament. I loved the Navy, and so I went back in.
Well, I'm sure you've heard a lot of people say a lot of things to you over the years, but I've interviewed 1,000 World War II veterans and many courageous, incredible men who blow me away with their stories. But just your story and what you just shared and your determination, that's really remarkable, sir.
Well, like I tell everybody, everybody had to be someplace.
Yeah.
And I was there.
And it's not like you took a Navy desk job somewhere. I mean,
no.
Statistically, the only thing more dangerous than being on a destroyer was being on a submarine.
I had to go through boot camp again, second time also, too. But
on the destroyer, and I can tell that you're proud of that ship.
That was like a 40-knot ship.
What were your duties on that destroyer?
Well, it was a gunner's mate. We were in charge. We had 4 or 5-inch guns and 2 dual 40-millimeter and about 8 probably 20-millimeters, and we had Y guns for the submarines, and we had torpedo tubes on board. So it was pretty well put together, and like I said, it was like 40 knots. That's moving across the water pretty fast for 1,500 tons of iron.
And what was your perspective in light of what you'd already been through? I mean, you've been through the most devastating day in American naval history.
Well, it was nothing. I don't know that I even thought about that. That was just past history, and it was already gone, and we're looking to the future.
Well, I guess what I wonder is, did you think, hey, I've already been through the worst, and I survived that, so nothing's going to get me? Did you think?
No, I just thought, this is where I belong, and this is where I volunteered to be, and we've got to be here till it's over.
And did you have some moments on that destroyer that you look back on now and say you were fortunate to survive those two?
Well, it was like I come out of the hatch one night at general quarters and an impulse charge went off right outside the hatch, throwing a depth charge overboard for submarine contact, and it kind of flashed back to me, and no, not again, you know.
Yeah.
But that was one of the things that happened, and like I said, everybody had to be someplace, and I was there.
What did it feel like when that war came to an end, having been where you were when it started?
Well, it felt great. I mean, everybody was hilarious, and I was in San Diego at a gunnery school there when that happened. And I just got home from 30-day leave, and I was ready to get discharged again. I got discharged in San Diego on December the 4th, 1945.
And went on. Maybe what I'm learning about you is this: you're just one that is used to living with danger, or you live on the wild side a little bit. What made you think that being a...
Not necessarily. It's just all in a lifetime, like I said, to work with the divers. I worked offshore. I was a barge master on one of the offshore largest drilling ships afloat at one time, and we worked in Alaska, we worked in South America, we worked in Colombia, we worked in Kuwait, we worked all over.
You would dive on oil rigs?
Well, I was just a tender. I'd run the phones and sending all the equipment to the divers and getting them up and getting them into decompression chamber and run the chamber and getting them back out on deck. And that's what diving is considered. You get them in the water and you get them up and decompress them, get them out. Everything works out all right. We have a few difficulties every once in a while, and we come through all of them. We never did lose anybody. So I was on the phones to the divers, and I'd send all the equipment to them and talk to them and told them what to do and what not to do and when to come up and when to stop for decompression, what this and that and the other. But so.
And you did that for, what, 30, 40 years?
Well, I don't know exactly how long, a long time.
Did any of those guys know your story?
Oh, I think they all do. They knew that I was a survivor of the Arizona and all that, so we never did talk about it much.
You mentioned when you were on the stack and that moment came, you flashed back to December 7th. Is that something that happens every once in a while, that those images come flooding back to you?
Well, sometimes just certain aspects that happen makes you think back a little bit, but I don't think about it much anymore at all.
And you went all these years, and you talked about it plenty, but now the book. What made you want to or convinced you that you needed to get all this in print and have this story told?
Well, that was nothing to my doing. Some young lady read something about my surviving the Arizona and whatever, and they talked to her father, who was a writer. His name was Ken Geyer. And he came here for an interview, and we talked about this and that and other, and then he asked me questions, and I gave him answers, and he put it in a book, and this is the way it happened.
How do you feel about it? How do you feel about the book?
Well, I think it's great. I mean, I get calls every day about it. I just read your book, and I think it's one of the best books I ever read in my life. And I hope it helps somebody and a reminder of things that could happen.
Yeah, that was my question. Because there's going to be thousands and thousands and maybe even millions of people who end up reading your book. What do you want them to get out of it? What's the most important message you want them to glean?
Well, we have to be alert in the United States here, and we have problems with ISIS and all the other stuff that's going on. And it's just a reminder that every day you should think about things that could happen in this United States and things that shouldn't happen. And if you're alert, and as you should be, well, maybe it won't happen. But we have to be very vigilant. There's people in countries that would try to tear down our aspect of way of living, and we can't let that happen.
How many times have you been back to Pearl?
Well, quite a few times. I think the first time I went back was 25 years later, but I was there for the 75th, but quite a few times in between.
What made the biggest impression on you there this last time, the 75th anniversary, where really the world's attention was on that memorial?
Well, it was just an idea that they entombed two sailors off the Arizona on there at the same time I was there, and on the wall is there with all the casualties and whatever, and it just makes you think what could happen again and how vigilant we should be, and it's something that we should think about every day.
That was Don Stratton's mission for more than 78 years after the attack on Pearl Harbor, to honor his fallen shipmates and to help keep America alert. In the last few years, he was determined to honor Joe George. That was a name for decades that he didn't know, but once he found out the identity of the man who had disobeyed an order and tossed the heaving line from the USS Vestal that saved his life and those of five other sailors, not to mention all their descendants born since, Don and his family made it their mission to see Joe George recognized. U.S. Senator Cory Gardner of Colorado was instrumental in making that happen. He spoke at Stratton's memorial service as a B-25 bomber circled in tribute overhead in Colorado Springs.
As we hear the planes flying over us to commemorate the life of Donald Stratton, I can't imagine what it must have been like for Don Stratton. Velma, thank you for sharing him with us all. You know, December 6th, he wrote about how he believed he was the luckiest kid on earth, the luckiest Nebraskan on earth who could be at Pearl Harbor, the most beautiful place on earth. Woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning on December 7th, got ready for a day, put on the Sailor's Away uniform that morning, t-shirt, press shorts, sailor's hat. 5:30 Reveille was over the intercom, and the ship came to life, and a few hours later at 7:55, Donald Stratton could hear the bombs and the airplanes and seeing what was happening across the harbor. Well, at 8:06, a 1,700-pound bomb fell from the sky 10,000 feet above, going through four decks of steel to the munitions of the ship, exploding, sending a 500 to 600-foot fireball into the sky. Where that morning, Donald Stratton, who had been leading the effort, anti-aircraft efforts, along with his fellow shipmates, stood their ground to fight back. And of course, we all know the story from there, how he was injured, spent a year recovering, went back into the fight, served in the Pacific. And how did he say it, Randy? He may have gone out on a stretcher, but he came back on a destroyer with reinforcements. The fight didn't stop there, because he spent then the time of his life finding Joe George, who threw that lifeline to him on the USS Arizona to save his life, lives of others. I first met Donald Stratton and the family when they came to our office talking about Joe George and what we could do to posthumously recognize Joe George, the man who saved his life. And the fight that he continued on for his life, for Joe George, to make that recognition happen. On December 7th, 2017, that indeed did happen. Donald Stratton won yet again because Joe George received the Bronze Star with V for Valor device at the Pearl Harbor Memorial on the USS Arizona, and he was once again there. A funny thing has happened, I think, to the Stratton family, because Donald Stratton has become bigger than Donald Stratton. He's become bigger than all of us. He's become a symbol of who we aspire to be, a nation that we know we are, a people who come together in time of great challenge and strife and conflict to rise above, to get back on your feet, to get into the fight, to continue a life, to share it with others and make it meaningful with others. He's an example that we hope we can all live to be. He's somebody that I know this country will greatly miss. I was honored to have known him and the family, and I look out right now at what Donald Stratton and Velma have made possible, but knowing too that Joe George has made it possible for you all to be here. I don't know if I would have had the courage or the strength to be there when Donald Stratton was there, but thank God he was there, and thank God he is here with all of us, because I know that at the pearly gates, Reveille this morning was a little bit more full, and roll call's almost complete, not just for the USS Arizona, but for a generation that made this country.
Powerful words from Senator Cory Gardner at the memorial service for USS Arizona survivor Don Stratton. It's time for another break, but we're not done yet. We'll hear more of Don Stratton's own words when we come back, and more tributes to a man whose legacy endures. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, dedicating our hour this week to Don Stratton, whose body was returned to his native Red Cloud, Nebraska this week after a 400-mile funeral procession from Colorado Springs. If you've read his best-selling book, All the Gallant Men, you know a little about the burden he carried for decades after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Not just the physical and emotional scars, but one thing that became very clear to me when I visited his home in Colorado Springs, the responsibility he felt in keeping the memory of his shipmates alive. Every day, for decades, he would receive mail from all over the world. Questions about Pearl Harbor, requests for autographs. Those tragic events of December 7th, 1941 affected every day the rest of his life. And he made sure to turn that disastrous day into perspective for the rest of us and vigilance for our country. I asked Don in 2017 how often he had to face the visions, the memories, the haunting reality of the USS Arizona's final moments.
Sometimes it comes quite often, but it's kind of like old hat now. It's been so many years. I think about the casualties a lot, but nothing I can do about that. The good Lord already taken care of that.
Are you planning someday to have your remains there with your shipmates?
No, I'm not, because like I told Danny Martinez, that's the overseer of the Pearl Harbor Memorial there, I said, I'm not going to be buried on the ship because I've already been cremated once. And
do you raise some eyebrows with that already been cremated once line?
Well, some people just kind of say, well, yeah, I guess, maybe, you know, so.
Well, there's some truth to it there, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
You've probably been asked this before, and maybe it's a hard one to answer. But in those 1,177 from your ship who didn't make it through December 7th, I'm sure you knew quite a few of them.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever wondered about what their lives would have been like?
Well, it's not for my decision to be look like that. I mean, I'm here from the sake of the good Lord and whatever, and the casualties are casualties, and there's nothing you can do about it.
You have quite a display here, right next to us, a beautiful scale model of your ship. You can point out exactly where you were that morning of December 7th. You've got your medals on the wall, including the Purple Heart, the campaign ribbons that you earned on the stack after that. You've got a cross made out of the rusted superstructure of your ship, the Arizona. Is there any of those that maybe means the most to you or is the most powerful for you when you walk past and look at it?
No, it's just something that's happened in my lifetime.
For that year that you're sitting in the hospital, and they've got you under the lamp, and these skin grafts are healing up, and this body that was almost extinguished is coming back to life. Did you imagine that you were going to have a wife, have children, grandchildren, have the career you have?
I've probably never even thought about that at that time. I was only 19 years old, and I was pretty well hurt and just wanted to get well and get on with my life, and that finally happened.
Have you ever encountered someone else who went through what you went through, was injured to the extent that you were, and got back in the service?
Not that I can really recall, but there was a lot of people in the hospital the same time I was there, so maybe their lifetime is halfway a story what mine was like, but that doesn't affect my lifetime right now. I'm doing pretty well, and I'm very thankful to be here, so that's the way it goes.
You've mentioned the good Lord quite a few times here. How real is that for you? Are there times where you really felt there was a divine presence or intervention?
Well, I think that's in everybody's mind, and what's happening with the good Lord and God and what our life would be like without Him, and live according to what you think that's really happening. So some divine power has got a lot to do with a lot of things that happen to people and don't happen, and so you live with it.
Sounds like you're saying you realize you're not always in control.
You're not ever always in control, outside of maybe some pertinent things that come along and that interfere with your lifetime.
What would you say that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, that I'm still here on Earth, and I've been married for 66 years, and I've lived a pretty good lifetime.
Of everything you dealt with during World War II, from those first moments when you're engulfed in flames to recovering in the hospital against all odds to all that time on the stack in real hazardous situations on a destroyer. What was the hardest thing that you ever had to face in the Navy?
I don't think there was really any hardest thing. It was just that you had to make yourself enjoy your surroundings and your shipmates and how you got along with them and how your lifetime was going to wartime and thought maybe what you would do after the war was over and a few things like that. But it, you know, just an ordinary lifetime.
Have you run up against any misconceptions about Pearl Harbor that you want to set people straight on?
Well, it's very negligent of our commanding officers and whatever that disregarded the sinking of the submarine off the harbor and the planes coming in from the north and some 200 planes that supposed to be maybe 17, and just total disregard, and we were really caught off guard, and we had to pay the price, and it cost a lot of lives, and it's gone, and it's over with, and we're back to normal, hopefully, and I hope we're alert, a little more alert now than we were then. But we'll just go on till our lifetime's over with, and that's the last survivor is gone, and that's going to be the end of that, so.
Is there one part of that memorial that means the most to you? One aspect of being out there and taking it all in?
No, it's just public to see and a reminder to everybody what happened and how many lives was lost that day, and we've got to be very vigilant. It could happen again.
Well, we will hope and pray that it doesn't, and if it does, we'll hope and pray that there are men like you to answer the call the way you did.
Well, I'm sure there is, and there's a lot of people and a lot of lives that went through as much as I did and more probably, and still very vigilant and still very happy to be still around, and that's it.
Well, I just want to say one more thing, sir, and I'm sure a lot of people have said it to you over the years, but I want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, not just once, but having the determination to get back in there and do it again, and thank you so much for telling us a story that really no one else could tell.
Well, thank you. Like I said, everybody had to be someplace.
That is truly how Don Stratton felt about his place in history. His body is now back in his native Red Cloud, Nebraska, after that funeral procession from Colorado Springs this week. Even the acting Secretary of the Navy, Thomas Modley, made it a point to be there.
It's an incredible honor for me to be here to celebrate this great American. And on behalf of the entire Department of the Navy, my wife Robin and I want to extend our deepest condolences to Don's family, Don's wife Elma, his son Randy, and Randy. Heroism comes in many forms, but your steadfast commitment to your father and his wishes to honor the man who saved his life and made yours possible qualifies in my eyes. Brother Willie, all of Don's grandchildren and great-grandchildren, Don said, "God has a funny way of connecting people at the right place at the right time." Those were the words that he spoke with his fellow Arizona survivor, Lauren Bruner, after they wrote me in my office last year. As Don and Lauren described in their letter, quote, "The ship was ablaze. Our shipmates were dead, wounded, and fighting to live. We, along with four shipmates who were all wounded in various ways, to varying degrees, had no way out. Joe George, on board the USS Vestal, successfully threw us a line from which we had climbed 60 feet off the USS Arizona through the smoke and the strafing. I can't imagine the strength, perseverance, and determination it took for Don and his shipmates, already badly burned, to traverse that rope and reach the safety of the Vestal's deck. Nor can I imagine the emotions that Don must have felt when he walked into my office, the office of the Undersecretary of the Navy, and saw the bell of the Vestal sitting there. He saved us, Don wrote. He did the right thing. And in turn, Don Stratton did the right thing. Using that gift of life to continue serving his country and then returning home to raise a wonderful family and standing strong for his community, as you all know. But as he quietly melded back into the incredible society that he sacrificed to save, it never sat right with him that he didn't know the identity of the man who saved him that day. And when Don finally uncovered the identity of this savior at a 2001 reunion, 5 years after Joe George died, it definitely didn't sit right with him that this American hero had never been recognized. So it's no surprise that Don spent nearly the final two decades of his life fighting to ensure that the name of Joe George would not be lost to history, as it had been undiscovered to him for so many years. This man and his family would not be deterred. They contacted the Navy over and over. Sometimes we're not the most responsive organization. They reached out to congressmen, senators, the Secretary of Defense, and the President of the United States. And then finally, as Senator Gardner mentioned, in 2017, their efforts finally bore fruit. Only one decoration has been awarded at the Arizona Memorial, and it was the Bronze Star with the V for Valor, awarded posthumously to Chief Petty Officer Joe George. On behalf of a grateful nation, I want to thank Joe's daughter, Joanne, who's here somewhere, there she is, for accepting that award and for being here today. It should never have taken this long, but it was undoubtedly and unquestionably the right thing. And it would never have happened without the gratitude and selfless determination of Don Stratton. And that's the thing about this greatest of American generations. They aren't just great. They're really, really good. It's never about themselves. It's always about others, their fellow warriors, their families, their communities, the people unborn and unknown to them who would benefit from their sacrifice. They never lost sight of that North Star. As a generation and as individuals, they did the noblest of things. They gave themselves. This year marks the 75th anniversary of our victory over tyranny in World War II. Looking back, we have a tendency to think of that victory and the growth of our nation as being inevitable. But there was nothing inevitable about the decision of a boy named Don Stratton from Red Cloud, Nebraska, to raise his right hand and commit to serve on distant shores. There was also nothing inevitable about another boy named Joe George to turn down a football scholarship at the University of Georgia to enlist on a maintenance ship. This was their choice. And there was nothing inevitable about the courage, determination, and strength that would join their lives together across a sagging rope over a burning sea in one of the most beautiful places on earth. There was nothing inevitable about Joe George's decision to toss a lifeline to a sinking ship instead of cutting loose that ship so it could be saved. And there was nothing inevitable about Don Stratton's courage and determination to make it across that sagging line up from its lowest point over that burning sea. This was their shared destiny. Pearl Harbor was also the low point on the rope of our nation, indeed for our world. It was dark. It was violent. But through that darkness, there was a voice. "Come on, kid," Joe George yelled to Don Stratton, and the only exchange they ever had. "You can do it." So hand over scorched hand, Don and his shipmates climbed up from that low point. They all made it across that treacherous span of burning fuel, exploding shrapnel, and strafing bullets, on to safety, because one American sailor believed in them, believed in himself, and made it so. What made the veterans of Pearl Harbor extraordinary was not that they survived, but that they fought back for each other. In the movie Tora, 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 there's a quote of Admiral Yamamoto saying, quote, "I fear all we have done is to awaken a sleeping giant and fill him with the terrible resolve." Don Stratton was the giant that was awoken that day. So was Joe George. So was every other Pearl Harbor survivor who returned to the fight. The sleeping giant was every sailor, Marine, soldier, airman, Coast Guardsman who answered the call without hesitation. The fate of humanity was in their hands, and they exceeded what was required to secure that fate. "Everybody has to be someplace," Don used to say when someone would thank him for his service. "I was just where I was supposed to be." And because that generation was where they were supposed to be, we have the freedoms that we enjoy today. We must honor them all, because every day we enjoy the freedom they bequeath to us is a tribute to their legacy. They represent everything that is good about our nation. They must stand at the center of our common memory and our understanding about the unique place we hold in the history of civilization. Today, I'm so grateful not only to Don Stratton, the veteran, but to Don Stratton, the historian, the recorder of memory, who wrote a stirring memoir called All the Gallant Men. He said, "I wanted to save from the fire something of my memories of the Arizona so that younger generations and all the children to come after them can understand why Pearl Harbor mattered." Because Don took the time to reopen old wounds and revisit those difficult times, he will live on as an eloquent voice for all of his shipmates. He said, "We were ordinary men. What was extraordinary was the country we loved. We loved who she was, what she stood for. We loved her for what she meant to us and for what she had given to us." May God bless Don Stratton and keep him, bring comfort to the entire Stratton family as they mourn and celebrate his life, a life of honor to which we should all aspire as Americans. Thank you very much.
Acting Secretary of the Navy Thomas Modley speaking at the memorial service for Don Stratton. Again, you can watch that entire service online. I have the link for you at hometownheroesradio.com, in addition to a link for Don's best-selling book, All the Gallant Men. An incredible man, a humble hero, and as you heard the Secretary of the Navy say, an example to all of us. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, echoing that axiom that the life of Don Stratton underscores so powerfully. Freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.